metro stations. The October District also began to wage war on the Communist Party organization that had run things for so long. Zaslavsky stripped the Shabalovka Street headquarters of all its communist trappings, the busts of Lenin, the hammers and sickles, and then pushed the party bureaucracy out of the way. He gave them a few bad offices on a high, drafty floor and took away their internal phone lines. "Let them fend for themselves," he said. "These people have no more right to this building than the Christian Democrats or the local Birdwatchers Association." Zaslavsky and his colleagues knew what they wanted to do, but they wanted at least the pretense of consensus before they did it. I went along and heard Zaslavsky tell the local police force that the city, and not the Interior Ministry bureaucracy, should be hiring and firing police officers. I saw him try to describe, to a room filled with befuddled factory workers, how it was time that they had shares in their own workplace, that inefficient or polluting plants should be shut down and replaced with factories that worked cleanly and made things that people need. Zaslavsky also knew that the creation of a real market would lead to higher prices, unemployment, bankruptcies, and the end of relatively equal incomes. And he said so. He was cold and honest, and the reception he got was never easy or enthusiastic. At a machine factory one afternoon, Zaslavsky sat on the podium under a huge banner. "The name and work of Lenin will live forever." And, once more, got an earful. "What are you going to do about all those Azerbaijanis selling in our markets? These kebab salesmen are making a fortune on our backs. They buy up all the meat, and they sell it for 3 and 4 times the original price. Don't make us your lab rats for capitalism." The workers were understandably more concerned with their daily disasters than with grand designs and new October revolutions. Zaslavsky tried to explain the difference between the black market and a real market, the need for competition, regulation, incentive. He was getting nowhere. "If I had known about all this, I never would have voted for you," one worker shouted. By the end of the session, Zaslavsky and Vasilyev were depressed. The euphoria of the election campaign was fading fast. "We never understood just how deep the psychology of Bolshevism is in every one of us," one aide, Ilya Gazentsevai, told me. "The harder we try to push, the harder that psychology pushes back." For months, they floundered. But slowly, Zaslavsky and Vasilyev's economic planning began to pay off. Their first stroke of genius was to make the October region the Delaware of Moscow. The regional council passed measures making it easy for private businesses to register in the region. With no party bureaucracy to impress or bribe, the businesses came in droves. More than 4,500 small enterprises registered in the region within 12 months, nearly half of all the new private businesses in Moscow. Restaurants, brokerages, commodities exchanges, private research labs, construction firms, law firms, and an electronics store opened. Taking in a percentage of the business profits as tax, the October region raised its annual income from 73 million rubles to 250 million rubles in 1 year. In the October region, you could see the first signs of a market economy. The ambition, the fast profits, the crime, the bewildering greed. The October Revolution, as the local papers called it, was a gold rush for a hustler like German Sterlyagov, a 24-year-old college dropout and one of the self-proclaimed pioneers of Soviet capitalism. He set up a private commodities brokerage and named it after his dog, Alisa. Just like that. And within 6 months, he told me, he was worth tens and tens of millions of rubles. Sterlyagov made his fortune in the vacuum left by the collapse of the old command system. As the system deteriorated, it was becoming impossible for builders to get bricks, for truckers to get oil and gas. Alisa filled in where the old ministries would not or could not. When I visited him at the brokerage house on Leninsky Prospect, he acted like a child sultan. Everywhere there were pretty young blonde women wearing spandex miniskirts. Sterligov's angels. "They are assisting me," Sterligov said with a leer. He had big dreams, and what was more, he was fulfilling them. Sterligov was the owner of the country's first professional hockey team, and the founder of the Young Millionaires Club, a place where like-minded tycoons could get together and make big plans. "Oh, and another thing," he said as his secretary stooped to light his Marlboro. "We're going to take over the Moscow racetrack and bring in the Kentucky Derby people to set up some big-time international racing." As he grew rich, Sterligov developed a stony heart. "Why should I pity the poor and the lazy?" he said. "Pity the sick and the weak, okay. But if the rest want to live in poverty, God help them. If they want to be slaves, well, then every slave has his dignity before God. But history is made by the individual, not the crowd. It is only when the ignorant crowd takes part in the historical process that it turns into a mess. My generation despises the system. It killed everyone and everything it touched. This was the richest state in the world, and they destroyed it all down to the bone. But older people don't understand us. Their psychology is all screwed up. They are so used to being equal in poverty that they assume if you have any money, you are a crook." Sterligov was not a lonely robber baron. The newspaper, Tochka Zrenia, Point of View, reported that there were at least 150,000 ruble millionaires in the Soviet Union by the end of 1990. "But look, a million rubles on the open market is now $25,000. "Is that really so much?" Sterligov said. "And I don't have a single free ruble. Everything is tied up in the business." After our talk, one of Sterligov's men showed me around the trading floor, which was buzzing with brokers and angels. "Welcome to the future," said Yevgeny Gorodentsev, an Alisa broker who had just put together a brick deal that brought him 750,000 rubles in commissions. He was 21 years old. The brokers all talked of Sterligov as if of a god, a slightly mad deity. His people reminded me of the inner circle around Citizen Kane. They knew he would crash, but they wanted to be next to something transcendent and new. Sterligov's ambitions were boundless and wild, a mix of Thatcherian free market zeal, Chicago in the 20s, and P.T. Barnum myth-making. When I last saw him, his newest scheme was to buy a huge tract of land 150 miles from Moscow and build a self-contained mini-Western country, with factories and accredited schools and universities, airports and heliports, satellite dishes, and a Japanese TV for everyone. Perhaps the singular feature of Sterligov's wealth was the envy and the harassment it attracted. Once a week, police inspectors showed up at Alisa demanding to see his books. The KGB dropped in, too. To avoid racketeers demanding protection money, Sterligov, his wife, and their infant daughter moved from apartment to apartment. The same dangers appeared to await anyone who succeeded in the new marketplace. Of the 12 new members of the Young Millionaires Club, only Sterligov would reveal his name. Dozens of others told him they wanted to join but feared kidnapping and attacks. The Communist Party weekly Glasnost printed an article accusing Sterligov of a pathological hatred of communism, a history of racketeering, and a real lack of intelligence. The attacks came from all sides. So successful was Alisa in its first 6 months of existence that rival entrepreneurs told me that they were sure Sterligov had a working relationship with the KGB. There were rumors that one of his uncles was a minister. Sterligov, like most plutocrats, immunized himself from criticism and convinced himself that everyone was simply jealous. "It's still a sin to be rich in this country," he said, "but we are going to change all that. It won't take long. Liberals in their late 30s and 40s were not so much angered as amazed at this new, younger generation. My friend Alex Kahn, a music critic from Leningrad, grew up in semi-dissident circles reading Samizdat and listening to pirated tapes of John Lennon. Now the young seemed entranced by money and the possibility of money. "Every month, every week, you see more of these guys around town," he said. "My generation, in our late 30s and 40s, worshipped the ideas and ideals that were forbidden to us. We looked to the poets and the bards. These guys are sick of all that. What they want most is a society that works." The young millionaires were an arrogant lot. Young men, never women, acting without a developed code of behavior or common language. Primitive capitalists, as Marx called them. The hardliners despised the new breed, and the liberals saw them only as a necessity, a first step toward a decent material life. "Some of them are a crude bunch, but to develop wealth you need these people. We can't wait for angels to do the spade work," said Igor Sfinarenko, a reporter for the leading newspaper of the Soviet business world, Kommersant. "These businessmen who make their money selling rotten meat or lousy computers or patched-together trade deals, they'll accumulate money and build things and set up factories and stores. Some of them may do ugly things or act like barbarians. But they'll also educate their kids, maybe send them overseas to Harvard. And then the kids will come back with their high-minded ideas and they'll say, 'Dad, you are a scoundrel.' And so they'll do things in a more refined way. They'll act on their guilty conscience. And so society will develop from there." If there was a Soviet model for the young millionaires, it was Artyom Tarasov, a high-tech and trading magnate in his 40s who was a constant target of KGB and police investigation for the allegedly illegal export of capital. Tarasov was the first of the Soviet millionaires to flaunt his wealth publicly, even describing his real estate deals and foreign trips at a press conference at the Foreign Ministry. He once suggested publicly that Gorbachev might sell the disputed Kuril Islands back to the Japanese for billions of dollars. Infuriated, Gorbachev threatened to sue, and the KGB investigations increased. By 1990, Tarasov was spending most of his time on the French Riviera, fishing and waiting for the right moment to come back home. "I've been fascinated watching this generation, these young Tarasovs, and it's clear they love the game more than the money as an end in itself," said Vladimir Alexanyan, an emigre who ran an import-export business with offices in Palo Alto, California, and Moscow. "They work 16-18 hours a day. Their mentality is completely different from anyone I ever knew before I left 12 years ago. They speak foreign languages. They come to the States and they rent cars, move around. They are absolutely fearless. They talk about renting military transport planes from the army to fly over some product. And they don't even realize how mind-boggling this sounds to anyone over the age of 30. An example of the breed was Anton Danielets, a 24-year-old information services and real estate czar in Leningrad. He was a moon-faced naïf with the bovine grace of a young Jackie Gleason. He claimed by 1991 a fortune of 20 million to 30 million rubles and $1.5 million in foreign banks. Danielets used a dying communist institution, the Komsomol, to build his nascent empire. In the first rush of cooperative businesses in 1987 and 1988, he opened a video theater with Komsomol help and made 500,000 rubles in personal profit within a year. He learned management from a pirated copy of a business text published abroad. One of the first things he did next was to hire lawyers to guide me through the thicket of laws. The key to business amid the war of laws between Moscow and the republics, between cities and districts, he said, was to know just who owns what, who has the right to issue licenses. Racing around Leningrad from morning till night in a dilapidated Soviet Fiat, he quickly used his savings to rent and buy valuable properties and put some of his long-held ideas to work. He rented a run-down indoor pool and gym that the city had left for dead and turned it into a profitable sports center, popular with his fellow Soviet millionaires and the foreign community. He saw business on the rise and started a financial information center, a kind of Dow Jones in Leningrad. He started a popular newspaper, Nevskoye Vremya, Neva Times, and bought a printing press that had once belonged to the local Communist Party. In Siberia, the Urals, and Karelia, he traded in raw materials whenever the deal looks good. He had more than 1,000 people working for him. After a while, Danielets finally decided that the back seat of his car was not quite adequate as a corporate headquarters. And so, for 300,000 rubles, he bought the glorious three-story mansion at 47 Herzen Street, Vladimir Nabokov's childhood home. My forebears, too, were business people, gentry, and we're going to make this place look like it once did, Danielets said, pointing to rooms immortalized in Nabokov's memoir, Speak Memory. I think of this place as our connection to what we lost and what we want to regain. People forget that there was something known as a Russian business life before the revolution. Now we are nothing more, nothing less than a third-world country, at best. I want to restore what we had. So when people come to me with interesting projects, I invest, maybe with cash, maybe with equipment or space. Everyone knows that the smart guys in the Communist Party are trying to grab up as much as they can before they finally leave the stage. My attitude is this. Let them. Most of them are so stupid they don't even know what real business is. It's the young who are going to do the work over the years. We're building empires, but not evil ones. In classical Marxist theory, the initial stages of the accumulation of wealth produce morbid symptoms. Chief among them in the Soviet Union was the rapid rise of thuggery, protection rackets, Ponzi schemes, the occasional murder and night of arson. Zaslavsky and the police faced problems with crime all over the district, especially on blocks with new private businesses. For some reason, though, I had better luck meeting the mob in Leningrad. Alex Kahn said he knew someone who knew someone who sold computers and whatnot out of a storefront in the Vasilyevsky region of the city. The businessman, who was named Alexander, told us just to bring a bottle or two of scotch, Johnny Walker if you've got it, at 2 in the afternoon, and we might meet some interesting people. Happily, the hard currency store in the Astoria Hotel was well stocked with Johnny Walker. The office was a shambles, a room filled with spiderwebs, scrap lumber, dust, and a desk and a phone. Alexander quickly said the scotch was not for him, and, under the circumstances, he would prefer I didn't print his last name. It was soon clear why. Within 5 minutes, 4 brawny types arrived. The Charity Society, they called themselves. It was time to collect the weekly 5,000-ruble donation from Alexander. I handed over the scotch, Alexander handed over a paper bag, and the Charity Society boys seemed happy. They were only too pleased to talk, they said brightly. Some people call us gangsters, an ex-athlete named Sergei explained as he popped a knuckle. We like to think of it this way. We protect people. We persuade them to let us protect them. Sometimes, Sergei said, they used pistols and Uzis, bought on the black market, as their instruments of persuasion. Pasha, a wiry hood who went a little crazy fighting in Afghanistan, explained how he and his partners did their business during what economists in the press were now calling the transition period from a centralized socialist economy to a free market, and what the punks referred to as the Wild West and Chicago in the 30s. First, everything is explained to the businessman in question, very slowly and carefully. Then, if he doesn't seem to understand the kind of payments he has to make, he's beaten up. But professionally, a couple of broken ribs, a few nights in the hospital. The next step is he's hustled into a car, driven out to the woods, and given a shovel. We tell him to start digging his own grave. That's usually when they crack. There was no way to know whether their stories were fact or cheap bravado. But such rackets did exist. Such murders went on all the time. And Alexander, a Nordic-looking man in his late 30s, tried hard to keep from trembling as he listened. Occasionally he shot me an anxious glance. To make everyone just a little more nervous, Sergei broke into the sort of half-mad giggle that Robert De Niro used to great effect in the film Mean Streets. The mannerisms, it turned out, were as imported as the Reeboks on their feet. Sergei admitted that he had seen the films Once Upon a Time in America and Goodfellas on the Charity Society's video system. "We learn a lot of what we do that way," he said. With private business growing by the day here, life was good for the Charity Society. They shook down everyone from the owners of newspaper kiosks to department stores selling foreign goods. "Just the price is different," Sergei said. "When I get about 2 or 3 million for myself, then maybe I'll go out and get some principals," Pasha said. "I've got plenty of time later on to buy a farm and live quietly." After the Charity Society left, Alexander said paying protection money was just part of doing business nowadays. His only other expense was his phone bill. "This country is in a state of transition, a wild time. And so there are no rules, no stability. It's open season," he said. "I know of one guy who couldn't make his payments, and they tortured him with a soldering iron. 99% of the businessmen in town, me included, violate a lot of rules. Taxes, hard currency restrictions, the laws on hiring people. We have to break the law if we want to get anything done. And so the racketeers know we can't resist. Calling in the police is hopeless. That is, unless you want to spend the rest of your life in a fortress, or dead in the canal." During the Brezhnev era, the personification of sleazy business dealings was the Tolkach, the weary factory representative who would travel the country to make sure he got the supplies his firm needed. Bribes and gifts were his stock in trade. If he was from Moldavia, he would bring cases of wine to sway his clients. If he came from Astrakhan, it would be quart-sized tubs of black caviar. But the Tolkach was only the comic face of a degraded, dishonest system. Corruption permeated the centralized economy from the bottom to the top. From the state butcher shop manager who sold his best beef on the black market, to the members of the Council of Ministers, who lied about production levels to curry favor with the General Secretary. That legacy of cynicism and lawlessness, despite all the talk of reform, still lingered. The standard of dual honesty for 70 years here has led to a deterioration of ethical standards, said Vladimir Alexanyan, the emigre import-export executive. "You rob your workplace. You cut in line. You skip out on contracts if it's convenient. Dishonesty is deep-rooted. When a person in business is honest, it is because he has made a conscious and usually temporary decision to be honest. There is not a deep-rooted sense of ethics." Corruption was a matter of course. In Leningrad's Kirov district, officials and businessmen said, merchants quickly discovered that to do a simple remodeling job on a building, or to get a decent location for a kiosk, they had to pay off the district government's architect. Finally, the local police caught the architect, Timur Kuriev, taking a 9,000-ruble bribe in a public bathroom. One of the great scams of the Gorbachev era was known as the convenient collapse. In an effort to encourage semi-private cooperative businesses, the government issued huge startup loans at low interest rates. Some cooperators used the funding to open stores or services. but others, who did not believe the period of liberalization would last more than a few months and wanted to make a quick fortune, grabbed the money and, when the loan came due, said, "Sorry, the business failed." The bank could do little more than put a 12% lien on the debtor's meager state salary. Every time a new form of commerce began, it seemed, a new racket appeared alongside it. After Sotheby's held its first auction of modern Soviet paintings in Moscow in July 1988, black marketeers discovered a source of quick income. Soviet artists told me that a man identifying himself as Oleg Petrovich, alias the Gypsy, showed up with his henchmen at various artists' studios, demanding works that he knew would bring in big money when sold abroad for hard currency.
Friends of mine were hit bad, and they told me that I was on the guy's list for 4 or 5 paintings, specific ones that they saw in the Sotheby's catalog, said Lev Tobenkin, a Moscow painter who had sold many of his canvases abroad. They're very systematic. So far they haven't gotten to me, but I haven't been working very much in my studio these days either. Lieutenant Nikolai Mirakov, chief of the Moscow Police Investigations Department, said the evolving economic situation, the conversion to a market economy, will keep the rate of crime soaring for years. He said that while he needs 5,000 police to cope with rising crime rates, he has lost more than 1,000 officers in the past 2 years. They mainly go off to work in cooperatives, where their salaries are a lot higher, he said. KGB officers, some of them at the highest levels, often took an early retirement to use their connections in the official and underground economies and make a killing as businessmen. Sometimes the police went into business without turning in their uniforms. A Moscow detective was caught shaking down street vendors for bribes of 10,000 rubles a month, the business newspaper Kommersant reported. In 1990, the same officer had been voted the city's detective of the year. Businessmen in the October region and elsewhere told me it was easy to make millions of rubles. Step 1. Get a short-term loan of, say, 10 million rubles. Step 2. Launder the rubles, that is, convert them into dollars. One of the most common back-channel methods is to buy from a third party a paper obligation for money owed in semi-hard currencies, Indian rupees, Chinese yuan. The paper obligation, for which you have paid dearly, makes the transfer to dollars much easier. Step 3. Buy goods. Japanese VCRs, Hong Kong computers, American blue jeans. Volume and a foreign label matter far more than quality. Step 4. The easiest part. Sell the goods to a middleman or a commission store or a workplace. Make sure your prices are absurd. Soviet consumers are desperate, and the demand curve knows no bounds. Step 5. Collect your money and pay off the bank. In 3 or 4 months, if all goes smoothly, you will be several million rubles richer. It seemed painless. But then I met Oleg Falkovich. A plump man with a heavy measure of guile, Falkovich worked for 25 years in the state economy in Siberia and the Far East before he began dealing privately in construction materials, clothes, and video equipment. Eventually, he became a buyer for a company called Arto, which was looking to obtain millions of rubles worth of video equipment for resale on the Soviet market. Falkovich contacted another firm, Terminal, which agreed to get the televisions and VCRs from Japanese suppliers. A few weeks later, however, Terminal said the deal in Tokyo had fallen through, and Falkovich had to give the bad news to Arto. But Arto said it was going to suffer losses in the millions as a result of the deal's collapse because it had taken out short-term loans with high interest rates. The Arto bosses told Falkovich that the burden for getting back the money was on him. One spring afternoon, Falkovich said, and other sources confirmed, Three men forced him into a car and drove him to the Russia Hotel near the Kremlin. Once we were in a room, they started threatening me, saying that unless I signed a contract handing over to them 5 million rubles, they would rape me, kill my wife and daughter. This went on for days. But when they got to my family, I signed. I would have signed anything. Falkovich managed to reach one of his partners by phone, and the partner called some members of their acquaintance in the Uzbek mafia to come to Moscow and set their boss free. The team flew to Moscow and knocked on the door of the hotel room. But Rustam, the Uzbek leader, recognized one of the three men as an old friend and colleague. "It was a nightmare," Falkovich said. "Instead of freeing me, Rustam turned to one of the others and said, 'Once you beat the 5 million out of him, we'll beat out another million.'" Eventually, the police arrived at the Russia and sent everyone home. Later, they arrested the three men whom Falkovich accused of kidnapping him. But the men were released after 3 days of questioning. The police said there was insufficient evidence to prosecute. Falkovich claims the men were extortionists, and the three said they were not. "The whole situation was a blur," said Genry Resnick, the lawyer for Arto. In the meantime, Falkovich said he is sure he is a hunted man. He has moved his family from their home in Magadan to a secret location, and he is hoping to emigrate to the United States. With no relatives there, his chances for an entrance visa are not good. "I can't live this way any longer," Falkovich said. "In a normal world, they settle these things with contracts, or if it comes to that, with lawsuits. This kind of thing will go on and on in this country until we have real laws, real business, and not the kind of insanity we have now." Despite the morbid symptoms of the new capitalism, Zaslavsky and company had no intention of scaling back their ambitions. They were world beaters. Dmitry Chegodayev, the 27-year-old chairman of the district's media committee, began holding meetings with foreign investors about setting up a 32-station cable station system featuring an October channel. "We want to hook into Europe via cable TV," he said. There were meetings about how best to attract foreign investors, the capitalist leeches of Stalinist legend. The most ambitious plan, one that smacked of megalomania to Communist Party loyalists, was to create a huge business center on Gagarin Square, modeled on the La Défense complex in Paris. Important-looking documents were drawn up. The center would include luxury hotels, office buildings, underground parking lots, an exhibition center, a computer and communication center, a trade center, and a medical complex. But by the summer and fall of 1990, something else was happening. The Communist Party newspapers were beginning to hint at a counter-revolution. Suddenly, the most prominent free market advocates in the country were under attack, Zaslavsky included. Like the Soviet Union itself, Zaslavsky was flying into the heavy weather of a market economy without a flight plan or a radar screen. His vision of the future, a world of stock markets, computer centers, and shopping malls, met head-on with the endless barriers of habit and instability. The obstinate psychology of a people grown used to equality in poverty. Perhaps a little sooner than the rest of the country, the radical free market leaders of the October region encountered the limits of people's tolerance. Some workers in the district were growing angry with the new businesses. There were small demonstrations. Some of Zaslavsky's supporters began to turn on him. Many people in the district saw businesses like Alisa succeeding very quickly, while they still had to stand in lines for food. It outraged them, and they started screaming, "Give us! Give us!" said Zaslavsky's aide, Gazentsevay. Many people could not understand that the idea of government is not to provide the way parents provide for a child. What we were trying to do was set up the structures, the possibilities for everyone to have the chance to work and succeed. It came as no shock to Zaslavsky that a lot of the negative letters he got in the mail, to say nothing of the articles in the nationalist press, were anti-Semitic. As the business explosion intensified and the average wage bought less and less, resentment eventually made its way toward that fine end. Anyone with a little extra was a Jew. You heard the grumbling on the buses, on the streets, on park benches. Sometimes it became the stuff of public meetings and demonstrations. On June 6, 1990, at the Red October Cultural Hall in Moscow, 700 members of something called the People's Orthodox Movement met, and the level of hatred was startling. "We declare that the Jews bear collective responsibility for the genocide of the Russian people and other peoples of our country," said one speaker, Alexander Kulakov. "And we demand that Jews be forbidden to leave the country until a tribunal of the Russian people decides their fate. We express solidarity with the Arab world, which struggles with this evil. We also express solidarity with the German people. The Jews were never victims of the German people. The Germans were the victims of Jewish deception." Groups like the United Workers' Front, Motherland, and Unity all emitted similarly horrifying grunts, all in the name of proletarian justice and the call for a class war. Zaslavsky showed me some of his mail, where the word Jid, Yid, appeared more frequently than commas. It was as if he had ended up on the wrong side of a perverse class war, a focus of class resentment. Nash Sovremenik, Moscow Worker, and Molodaya Gvardia were the main publications supporting this strange amalgam of nationalism, neo-Stalinism, and pure resentment that was fast becoming known as National Bolshevism. "We face a paradox," wrote Richard Kosolapov in the Moscow Worker. "An actual ban on the class approach and its false contrast with universal human values is happening at a time when the gap between rich and poor is widening. We are stubbornly being told that there is a need for fraternization between striking coal miners and the growing ranks of millionaires, despite the fact that our entire historical experience is literally crying out about the inevitability of conflict." Zaslavsky had begun his term in early 1990 with the support of more than 100 of the 150 October Region deputies. But by winter, he could rely on only 40 or so. The rest, with help from various Communist Party organizations, began to plot against him. Articles began appearing in the Russian Communist Party paper, Sovetskaya Russia, accusing Zaslavsky of incompetence, of aggressive anti-communism, of taking power out of the hands of the people and putting it in the hands of a few young millionaires. "Zaslavsky was not the man we thought he was," said Alla Vlasova, a conservative on the council. "He turned arrogant. He would only listen to the inner circle around him. He has to go." Inexperience and a measure of arrogance also gave Zaslavsky's enemies ammunition for the approaching political battle. Some members of the city's executive committee, it turned out, were also businessmen. Vasiliev's deputy, Shota Kakabadze, for one, was president of the law firm Assistant, which did legal work for the region. Although the lawyers said they did their municipal work free, the impression of a conflict of interest became indelible. "We started falling victim to our own stupidity and inexperience," Chegodayev said. The biggest mistake was in the way Zaslavsky handled the privatization of several thousand parcels of land and new enterprises. The Municipal Property Board was in charge of holding auctions and selling off land in order to help create businesses, hotels, or plants that fit in with the October region's plans for the future. Zaslavsky saw the dilemma of mixing the state and the private sectors, but he argued that this was often done in other developing countries. "And that," he said, "is what we are, let's face it. A developing country that happens to have nuclear weapons. Upper Volta with rockets. Zaslavsky's enemies pounced all over him, accusing him of funneling profits to his cronies. And while the charge was never proved, it hurt him badly. Suddenly, the young politician who had started with a pristine image was stained. To make matters worse, Zaslavsky took a hit from a powerful corner. For months, Zaslavsky had been telling the press and even audiences abroad that Gorbachev was a lost cause, who was getting far too much credit for even beginning perestroika. He said that it was Ronald Reagan's strategy of negotiation through strength that brought the Kremlin to its knees. "I will never forget what Gorbachev did at the start," Zaslavsky said, "but it would be a mistake to put all our hopes in one man anymore. Thank God we're beyond that." Gorbachev, who was then turning sharply to the right, went before a meeting of the Moscow Communist Party organization and railed against the so-called Democrats. It was one of his most conservative speeches during a conservative winter in the Kremlin. Zaslavsky, in particular, Gorbachev said, had disappointed him. On the bitter cold afternoon of February 13, 1991, Zaslavsky's opponents called a council session and put a no-confidence vote on the agenda. To bring down Zaslavsky, however, they needed a quorum of 99 deputies. Zaslavsky's only remaining strategy was to block the quorum, to keep his people outside the hall. As he sat in his second-floor office, his opponents hammered him in the auditorium. "All summer Zaslavsky was in the United States. He is learning to destroy our political, economic, and ideological system," said Alla Jokina. "Zaslavsky's emissaries took their training in the United States," said Gennady Markov. "All his people now have cushy jobs." Yuri Mazanich said Zaslavsky's team tried to establish a totalitarian regime based on the arbitrary seizure of regional property. The denunciations went on from 5 to nearly midnight. Although the deputies were 5 short of a quorum, they held a no-confidence vote anyway, with 78 voting for Zaslavsky's resignation. It was beginning to look as though the October Revolution would not lead to the shining future of capitalism in one district. Zaslavsky sat in his office, exhausted. He was surrounded by the mementos of his rise to fame. The bric-a-brac from his trip to the United States. The aides who doted on him. The map of the future. The gleaming region he saw in his mind's eye. The revolution was at a stalemate. "It turns out this is going to be a very long game," he said. Chapter 22. Mayday! Mayday! I woke early on May Day, 1990, the annual festival of labor, sunshine, and kitsch. The weather was perfect, a sweet astonishment in the perpetually dreary city of Moscow. Rumor had it in the past that the Communist Party, in its constant attempt to tame the heavens and the earth, seeded the clouds so it would rain before and after, but never on the parade. May Day was a cartoon of what was happening in the country. You could just plant yourself on Red Square and watch it all go by. Under Stalin, May Day raised the cult of personality to the level of communal entertainment. Every float and billboard, every song and banner was devoted to the worship of his greatness. Under Khrushchev and Brezhnev, the atmosphere was still grotesque, but more jolly. Unsurpassed achievements of the working man at least equaled the unsurpassed wonderfulness of the leader. By 1988, there were still some portraits of the Politburo leaders and Central Committee-approved slogans, "Acceleration," floating by. But Gorbachev had reduced the ceremony mostly to a bit of tacky fun, a production worthy of halftime at the Sugar Bowl. Strongmen flinging golden dumbbells into the air. Gymnast nymphets jackknifing at the waist in honor of the working class. harmless Sovietiana. The banners were more in the spirit of self-help than national vanity. The country was collapsing, after all, and everyone knew it. It was in the papers every day. That year I also managed to run into Yeltsin as he wandered toward his modest car. He had not been seen around Moscow since his fall from power nearly a year before, and this was probably his last moment of shyness. "Oh, yes," he said with a fantastically broad smile. "He was quite healthy. We would hear from him soon." By 1989, the slogans had turned to a sugary mush. "Peace for everyone," one said. Or the touching, "We're trying to renew ourselves." It was also innocent. A 4th of July barbecue without the hot dogs. Ideology had disappeared. There were no "our rockets are bigger than your rocket" signs anymore. No boasting of magnesium production rates. No Uncle Sam's stepping on the neck of the Third World. An empire with thousands of nuclear warheads was eager to show just how toothless it had become. The Soviet Union was in the midst of a self-actualization craze. For 1990, Gorbachev decided to account for the new wave of young politicians in the various legislatures, city halls, and town councils. The Kremlin announced that the liberal mayor of Moscow, Gavril Popov, would be on the reviewing stand of the Lenin Mausoleum, along with the Politburo and a few selected government honchos. Yuri Prokofiev, the astonishingly dense leader of the Moscow Party Organization, also declared that factory workers would no longer be compelled to celebrate. "This year, May Day would be completely voluntary," he said. Only banners bearing anti-constitutional slogans would be discouraged. What a gesture, everyone was supposed to think. What a kind and liberal leadership. But, as usual, the party was acting more out of anxiety than generosity. They opened up the parade only in exchange for an agreement from Democratic Russia, Memorial, and other opposition groups that there would be no embarrassing countermarches across town. In Leningrad, the party was taking no chances. It cancelled the parade altogether. The morning was reliably gorgeous. A hard, bright sun and a cool breeze washed along faces that had turned the lightest shade of pale after the long winter. Along the walk north from October Square to Red Square, I saw a few people carrying a Lithuanian flag and some rolled-up banners. I didn't think much of it. I got to the reviewing stand early, bought an ice cream, and gossiped with some of the other reporters. The public address system pumped out some treacly Soviet pop tunes and Pete Seeger's "We'll See That Day Come Round." Finally, it was time for the ceremonies to begin. As always, the reporters took careful note of the order in which the various leaders walked up the stairs of the Lenin Mausoleum to the reviewing stand. Yeltsin and Gaidar Aliyev had told me how Gorbachev, like a baseball manager, would give everyone his place in the order just before showtime. Usually it was written on a little card or piece of paper, Yeltsin said. He also said that at lunch breaks during Politburo sessions, everyone sat in his usual May Day order. For the reporters, it was still considered slightly important who chatted with whom, who wore a fedora, who a Hamburg, and above all, who was missing. This was called Soviet watching. At least for me, the ritual lost its aura with the discovery that underneath the mausoleum there was a laboratory charged with monitoring the temperature and rate of deterioration of the living Lenin. Below that, there was a gymnasium where the guards could work out on off hours. The idea of some pimply kid from Chelyabinsk doing squat thrusts in the bowels of sacred territory somehow eased all mystery from the grand procession and the leaders who watched it. For about an hour, May Day was as calm and uneventful as the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. One merely had to substitute images of heroic labor for Underdog and Bullwinkle. Gorbachev watched with a bored, kingly smile, as if he were pleased to live through this hour of his life without crisis. The first marchers were mostly factory workers and members of official unions, and the signs they carried reflected their fear that a market economy would leave them without money or a job. "Enough experiments," one said. "A market economy is just power to the plutocracy," said another. "Down with private property." Even while they mouthed the slogans of the right wing, those workers demanded our sympathy. They had lived for decades in a world of guarantees, however meager, and absolute truths, however false. And now everything had been denounced, undercut, found out. They felt threatened to the core. The crowd moved from left to right, from the brick museum of the revolution, across the cobblestones of Red Square, then down the slope past St. Basil's Cathedral, and toward the steely Moscow River, glinting now like the oiled barrel of a .38. But suddenly the march seemed to run out of marchers. We all looked left and saw that another wave had gathered, but they were waiting, and they looked different. What was this? There were red, yellow, and green Lithuanian flags, black, blue, and white Estonian flags, Russian tricolors from the Tsarist era. There was shouting, more young people, an entirely different feel. Something was about to happen. You could feel it. Everyone could. These were the very people who would have gone off to counter-demonstrations had the party not cut a deal with them. Soon the party would wish it had never had this stroke of genius. The Democrats started marching onto the square, and now their placards became visible from the reviewing stands. I'd seen the same ones at other demonstrations, but on Red Square, with Gorbachev watching. Socialism? No thanks. Communists, have no illusions, you are bankrupt. Marxism-Leninism is on the rubbish heap of history. Down with the Politburo, resign. Ceausescus of the Politburo, out of your armchairs and onto the prison floors. Down with the Empire and Red Fascism. There were no portraits of the Politburo members, but there were numerous posters featuring Yeltsin. Tell him, Boris, and Sakharov, conscience of the nation. Then came the most chilling symbol of all. Red Soviet flags with the hammer and sickle ripped out. An echo of the opposition flags on the streets of Bucharest during the uprising of December 1989. The demonstrators all stopped and turned toward the Lenin mausoleum. The square was filled with tens of thousands of people now, waving their fists, chanting, Doloi KPSS, down with the party. Doloi Gorbachev! Doloi Ligachev! I borrowed a pair of binoculars and glimpsed the faces of the men on the reviewing stand. Later I got a closer look on television. Ligachev glared and nodded, his face hard as a walnut. Yakovlev was impassive, Yoda-like. Popov looked utterly serene, even pleased, though hesitant to let it show in such company. Gorbachev, as always, was a master of his emotions. As tens of thousands of people denounced him, he never let the minutest flicker of anger crease his face. I remembered other men in similar situations, how confused and frightened Ceausescu had looked when he listened to those first demonstrators from his balcony in Bucharest. Gorbachev's performance was as amazing as the demonstration itself. He watched and watched, and occasionally chatted with those next to him, as if this were the most common May Day parade in memory. As if it were normal. The confrontation seemed as if it might go on endlessly. The demonstrators were ready to stay in Red Square all day. We all stood there watching, still as lizards in the sun. The men on the mausoleum did not move. They merely stood there, as if they were watching something else, some other parade, instead of their own last judgment. Finally, someone ordered the Kremlin loudspeakers turned up, and they started churning out patriotic slogans and marching music. But it was no match for the chanting on the square, a surge that grew louder with every minute. This was their square, and there was not a goddamn thing anyone could do about it. At the center of the crowd stood a Russian Orthodox priest, his beard from the pages of Dostoevsky. He carried a 7-foot-high crucifix and shouted, "Mikhail Sergeyevich, Christ has risen!" Finally, after a full 25 minutes of this, Gorbachev nodded, turned on his heels, and walked off the tribune. What else could he do? Everyone, Popov included, followed. Later, I visited Popov at City Hall and asked him how he and Gorbachev had felt standing there on the mausoleum. "For me, it was interesting," he said. "For Gorbachev, I would say the word is uncomfortable." I also spoke to Yegor Ligachev, who told me that he had been deeply disturbed by the incident. "Not just me, but Mikhail Sergeyevich, everyone had this feeling," he said. "On the one hand, we gave the chance for any force to march on Red Square and express themselves. On the other hand, we witnessed such extremist outbursts, such blatant aggressiveness, that if they would come to power and we would organize such a demonstration, we would be sent directly to jail from Red Square. No doubt about that. I watched for a long time, and Mikhail Sergeyevich came up to me and said, 'Yegor, probably it's time to finish it.' And I said, 'Yes, it's time.' And we left, with me walking beside him. It was uncivilized. I said to Mikhail Sergeyevich, 'Once again we are seeing what a deplorable state the country is in.' These were my exact words." After Gorbachev and the rest left the reviewing stand on Lenin's tomb, I walked into the square and joined the march at its tail end. Everyone was jazzed with a sense of power. The leadership may try to dismiss what happened here today as just some extremists blowing off a little steam, but it runs deeper. Gorbachev has done a lot of good, but when it comes to us, the radical, he turns away from his natural allies, one demonstrator, Alexander Afanasyev told me. His face was streamed with sweat, flushed with the thrill of the standoff. A young man named Vitaly Mindlin, who was carrying a pro-Lithuanian banner, told me, "I've been forced to go to these rallies for years, and this is the first time I've come voluntarily, acting from my own soul. Gorbachev may have been insulted by our openness, but we have to take that risk. We can't afford to act as if we were someone's subject. We are our own masters. The people dictate the moment now, not Gorbachev." The party, of course, tried to make sure the country did not hear about the demonstrations. Official television gave blanket coverage to the first hour of the parade, but once the radicals crested the hill and entered Red Square, the broadcast ended. Of course, Glasnost subverted any attempt to control the information. The more liberal papers were filled with accounts of the May Day events, and the public read not only about Moscow, but about the anti-communist demonstrations in Eastern Europe and the anti-empire demonstration in Ukraine. The party had been humiliated nearly everywhere. In Lvov, the center of the Ukrainian independence movement, demonstrators carried icons of the Virgin Mary and signs saying, "USSR, the prison house of nations." The mayor of Lvov, Vyacheslav Chernovil, could not help but applaud. He'd spent the better part of his adulthood as a dissident and political prisoner. "Happy May Day," he told everyone. "Happy May Day." A few days later, Alexander Yakovlev had the pitiable job of facing the press. Playing against type, the most liberal man in the leadership denounced the May Day demonstrations as insulting and freakish. Yakovlev turned demagogue as he singled out the few kooks in the march, war veterans with pictures of Stalin, monarchists with icons of Nicholas II. He made out this lunatic fringe to be the main current of the demonstration itself, and then pompously declared that what we had witnessed that day were anti-reform forces trying to frighten the goodly men of the Kremlin. What a strange and terrible thing it must have been for Yakovlev to carry out such a task. Yuri Prokofiev, the Moscow party chief, was more honest in his anger. The crowds, he said, carried insulting slogans exceeding the limits of decency. They smeared the leaders of the country, the Communist Party, and the president, and chanted rude, almost obscene words and whistled. The goal of these people was explicitly clear: to spoil the holiday with the poison of confrontation. What a phrase! Almost obscene words! The party press scolded the tastelessness of the demonstration, as if the demonstrators had used the fish fork for the steak. Gorbachev, for his part, just kept away from the subject. What could he say? What he felt standing there at the mausoleum? What had Lyndon Johnson felt as he sat in the Lincoln bedroom or the Oval Office and heard the great throbbing coming from Lafayette Park? "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" In his own perverse way, Johnson had started out thinking of himself as doing good, raising up the poor, giving black folks a chance. And now he was a baby killer, a demon. Gorbachev's indignation on May Day must have gone even deeper. He had challenged institutions and a system many times more monstrous than anything a modern American could imagine. His maneuvering, his attempt to erode the power of the party and slowly build up democratic institutions, was the political feat of an age. No czar or general secretary had ever put himself and his power in such jeopardy. And now it had all gone wrong. Day by day, the people of the Soviet Union were developing minds of their own. Gorbachev cheered that, at least in principle. But the reality of a new psychology, independent and defiant, confused him, sent him running to the reliable bases of traditional power. He ignored those who told him what he did not want to hear. The only men who would flatter him were precisely those who would one day betray him. His tragedy had begun. The liberal press was forever wringing its hands over the lack of young people in politics. I found that strange. Red Square that May Day was filled with men and women in their 30s, 20s, and teens. Unlike Karpinsky, Afanasyev, Yakovlev, and Gorbachev, men who had been raised as true believers and then begun the long process of awakening after Stalin's death, the young had never believed for a minute. They did not believe in communism, the party, or the system. They did not believe in the future. As a secret Politburo analysis dated May 19, 1990, described the phenomenon, there was now in Soviet society an utter disrespect for the organs of state power. The Gorbachev years were not a negation for the young, but rather a chance to fill a void, to move from a despairing cynicism toward something resembling normal modern life in all its multiplicity. For the young, the instructions and pretensions of the existing system constituted a separate world of the absurd, a realm of lies so funny you could die laughing. The official indoctrination had started in the first grade. On the first day of school, the principal would gather all the children in an auditorium and tell them, "You are so lucky to be living in this country where all childhoods are happy ones." The first words in their readers were Lenin, Motherland, and Mama. The flyleaf bore a picture of the Lenin mausoleum, and in the 60s the last page of all textbooks had a portrait of Khrushchev with the caption, "Nikita Sergeyevich is a fighter for peace. He says to all peoples, let's live in peace." On Revolution Day the children were declared Oktyabritsy, children of October, and they wore star-shaped badges bearing little pictures of Lenin as a cherubic child. In the essay Less Than One, Joseph Brodsky captures the experience of school under the regime in two sentences. "It is a big room with three rows of desks, a portrait of the leader on the wall behind the teacher's chair, a map with two hemispheres, of which only one is legal. The little boy takes his seat, opens his briefcase, puts his pen and notebook on the desk, lifts his face, and prepares himself to hear drivel. In summer, the luckier children went to pioneer camps, where they played war games with balsa rifles and acted out the Siege of Sevastopol in evening song competitions. They were raised on a quaint prudery. During the Brezhnev era, the weekly Ogonyok magazine advised that girls should learn self-respect. Then there won't be any need to pass laws prohibiting kissing and hugging on the street. A woman's modesty increases the man's sexual energy, but a lack of modesty repels men and brings about total fiasco in their intimate relations. In 1980, an American researcher published Sex in the Soviet Union and cited one article in the official press declaring that premarital sex caused neurotic disorders, impotence, and frigidity. Another article said that the ideal duration of the sexual act was 2 minutes, and a man who delayed ejaculation for the pleasure of his partner was doing something terribly harmful, which could lead to impotence, neuroses, and psychoses. All this while many Russian girls, in the absence of effective birth control, were having one abortion after another. Those who grew up under Brezhnev were slowly crushed by a great invisible weight. Most conformed out of laziness, hopelessness, the music critic Alex Kahn told me one night. When I was 18 and in my first year of college, I was picking apples on a collective farm, and I was talking to a friend of mine every day in the field. And I remember how we concluded that we were living in the most sophisticated dictatorship that has ever existed on this planet. The force of the propaganda was so strong that there could never be a revolution from below. I knew all about Sakharov and the other dissidents, but they were a tiny island off by themselves. The system had permeated society at every level. It was everywhere. No one was being tortured, as in the Middle Ages or under Stalin, or at least not many. But the system was unshakable because it penetrated society so thoroughly. You could talk openly only with your closest friends, and even that was not always safe. But people of Alex's generation and younger grew up without the same sense of ever-present fear that their parents had known. The era of stagnation demanded obedience, but usually not your neck, not even your soul. For the first time, a generation began to distance itself from the system and look at it with disdain. It saw the strangeness and horror in all that had gone on before. Its relation to the state and its institutions was purely ironic. What seemed to save people was the cocoon of friendships, the feeling of independence and intimacy that long nights of talk could provide. My tutors in this were, above all, a quartet of friends in their mid-30s, so close to one another for so many years, that I feel presumptuous even now saying I was part of their circle. At least I was a kind of tangent to the circle of Masha Lipman and her husband, Seryozha Ivanov, and Masha Volkenstein and her husband, Igor Primakov. They were the sort of people you'd see in the audience at meetings of Memorial or Moscow Tribune, or joking and paying half attention at a rally somewhere on the outskirts of Moscow. Seryozha was a historian, Igor a seismologist, Masha Lipman a translator, Masha Volkenstein a pollster. They were not famous, but they knew people who knew this well-known artist or that reform politician. Of the four, I knew Masha Lipman best, because she eventually came to work for the Post. When we finally had the nerve to stop hiring the KGB-approved informers that the Foreign Ministry had always sent us, Masha went to work as a researcher and translator, finally displacing a harpy of the higher organs. Most nights, when we got together, the talk was about politics. I suppose that was always the way in a city of revolution. But after a while, Masha and Seryozha talked about their families, typical stories for educated people of their generation. My maternal grandfather, David Rabinovich, was born in Kharkov, in the Pale of Settlement, and he became enthralled with proletarian ideas, Masha told me. He was a typical Jewish intellectual, enthusiastic about a new era, a new art. He was a musician. When he came to Moscow and graduated from the conservatory, he taught Marxist political economy and was a member of the Russian Association of Proletarian Musicians. He wanted a new proletarian culture, loved Mayakovsky. For Jews, the revolution meant the idea of an end to the Pale of Settlement. Grandmother was an actress who studied with Meyerhold, worked in his theater of the revolution. My grandfather knew Shostakovich, and my grandmother played a vendor who sold fur-lined brassieres in a Mayakovsky play. It was incredible. They and their friends developed a revolutionary style even in the way they lived at home. They had no dishes, no real furniture. They decided it was all too bourgeois and left it all in Kharkov. Birthday parties, weddings, and New Year's trees were also gotten rid of. Bourgeois. To make a table, my grandmother found a few boards, scrap wood, and asked the super to make a table. They thought that traditional Russian felt boots, valenki, were also bourgeois. So the children walked through the slush and the snow in their thin leather shoes, crying of the cold. They just mocked all traditions of the old order. So they had my mother call them by their first names, and they ate their meals off of butcher paper. Nevertheless, Masha's maternal grandfather was sent to the camps for espionage. He had met a few times with an American reporter. He survived, returning home after Stalin's death. Her paternal grandfather was not as fortunate. Alexander Levitt was a revolutionary who worked in the Comintern and attended the 17th Party Congress in 1935. He used the pseudonym Tivel. The year after the Congress, he was arrested and disappeared. During the Moscow purge trials, Masha's grandmother turned on the radio and heard the voice of one of the accused, Karl Radek, testifying. It was Tivel who